Nataraja Narasimhulu remembered hearing the screams of those deemed too sick to live being buried alive. He was 18 years old. He'd been forced to work on the death railway in Kanchanaburi, Thailand, in 1943. 120 workers from his rubber processing factory in Malaya had been loaded onto trains. They'd been promised free train rides, healthcare, housing, and a daily salary of $1, nearly four times what the British had paid them. 41% of them would die there. 30,000 to 60,000 Malayans dead on the death railway. But here's what you need to understand about those screams. They weren't just the sound of Japanese brutality during World War II. They were the sound of a system that had been killing for 70 years before the first bomb fell on Pearl Harbor. Between 1886 and 1957, approximately 750,000 Tamil workers died during migration to Malayan rubber plantations. That's one death every 4 hours. For 70 years. Straight. Estate mortality rates during the rubber boom ran at 30 per thousand annually. That's 3% dying every year. For comparison, Britain's civilian death rate in World War I was less than 1%. And it all started with 70,000 seeds stolen from Brazil in June 1876. A British adventurer named Henry Wickham smuggled them to Kew Gardens in London by falsely declaring them exceedingly delicate botanical specimens specially designated for delivery to Her Britannic Majesty's own royal gardens. Brazil banned rubber seed export. Wickham knew this. He lied anyway. Those seeds gave Britain control of 75% of global rubber supply by World War I. They ended Congo's red rubber system, not through humanitarian pressure, but through economic competition that made plantation rubber cheaper than Leopold's wild rubber extracted through mutilation. They drove Henry Ford to Billfordlandia in the Amazon through Winston Churchill's price manipulation scheme called the Stevenson Plan. They prompted Japan's conquest of Southeast Asia. Malaya was, as one British lord put it, the greatest material prize in Southeast Asia. And they sparked Britain's forgotten war in the 1950s, called an emergency so Lloyd's of London insurance companies would pay claims. A war fought explicitly, as a Foreign Office secret file admitted, in defense of the rubber industry. This is the story of the British rubber monopoly in Malaya. One act of biopiracy that connected three continents through systematic exploitation. Different methods. Same commodity. Same consumers. Author Joe Jackson wrote that long before OPEC, Wickham seed theft gave England the first global monopoly of a strategic resource in the history of humankind. Henry Alexander Wickham was born in Hampstead, London, on May 29, 1846. He would spend most of his adult life in tropical America, Nicaragua, Honduras, and finally Brazil, trying and failing at various ventures. He attempted to grow sugar, tobacco, coconuts, bananas, and cacao. All failed. He tried exporting exotic bird feathers to London. Failed. By 1876, he was 30 years old, chronically broke, and living near Santrum on the Tapajos River in the Brazilian Amazon. But Wickham had been reading the newspapers. He knew that Charles Goodyear's vulcanization patent from 1844 had enabled rubber commercialization. He knew that John Boy Dunlop would soon patent the inflatable bicycle tire in 1887. He knew rubber demand was exploding. And he knew something else. In 1876, the British government was quietly offering payment for anyone who could deliver viable Hevea brasiliensis seeds to Kew Gardens. 10 pounds per thousand viable seeds. On June 15, 1876, Wickham arrived at Kew with 70,000 seeds packed in woven baskets. Brazilian customs officials had questioned him about the shipment. Wickham presented papers declaring the cargo as exceedingly delicate botanical specimens specially designated for delivery to Her Britannic Majesty's own royal gardens at Kew. The customs officials, apparently impressed by the official language and royal designation, allowed the shipment through. Of the 70,000 seeds, only 2,700 germinated, less than 4%. Wickham received £700. In today's money, approximately $120,000. Not a fortune, but for a failed planter, it was something. Kew Gardens immediately began propagating the seedlings. In 1876 and 1877, they shipped batches to Ceylon, modern-day Sri Lanka, and to Singapore. By 1877, the first rubber plants had reached Malaya via the Singapore Botanical Gardens. H. N. Ridley became director of the Singapore Botanical Garden in 1883. He championed rubber cultivation so aggressively that planters called him Mad Ridley or Rubber Ridley. He'd walk estate to estate, literally giving away rubber seedlings and teaching planters how to tap trees without killing them. By 1895, commercial rubber planting had begun in the Malay states. By 1897, 345 acres were under cultivation. By 1901, 15,000 acres planted across British Asia. By 1910, 542,000 acres. In 1913, 37 years after Wickham's seed theft, cultivated rubber overtook wild rubber globally for the first time. Plantation rubber accounted for 59.3% of world production. Congo's share had dropped to 2%. On June 3, 1920, King George V knighted Henry Wickham for his services to the rubber industry. Queen Victoria had reportedly considered him a disagreeable little man. Sir Joseph Hooker, director of Kew Gardens, had refused to let him help establish the Asian plantations. Wickham spent his final years poor, living at the Royal Colonial Club. He died on September 27, 1928. In Brazil, he's called the father of biopiracy and the prince of thieves. In Malaysia, there are monuments to him. But the question nobody asked Wickham, nobody asked Ridley, nobody asked the planters, nobody asked the British government was simple. Who would actually do the work? In 1874, 2 years before Wickham's seed theft, investigators arrived at the Malakoff estate in Province Wellesley. They'd received reports that 100 workers had fallen sick. What they found were dirty, dilapidated huts permeated with filth and a putrescent stink. An old man named Ramasamy was found beaten to death. The estate owner, J.M., Vermont, wanted to make flogging legal. He argued it was necessary for maintaining discipline. Vermont owned 4,500 acres. This was before the rubber boom. Most estates at this point still grew sugar, coffee, or pepper. But the labor system that would power rubber was already taking shape. In 1884, the Indian Immigration Ordinance formally established the framework for recruiting workers from South India. Male workers earned 12 cents per day. Female workers earned 8 cents. By 1907, as the rubber boom accelerated, the Tamil Immigration Fund Ordinance established the Indian Immigration Committee. By 1910, formal indenture, where workers were legally bound to estates, was officially replaced by something called the Kangani system. Here's how it worked. A Kangani was a labor recruiter, usually a Tamil who'd already worked on Malayan estates. He'd return to South India, typically to his home village or region, and recruit workers. The Kangani received payment for each recruit he brought. He also received ongoing commissions based on their productivity once they started working. This created an incentive structure where Kanganis prioritized quantity over honesty. A colonial judge, M. D. Beaumont, called the Kangani system a monstrous, rotten system, rooted upon slavery, grown in its worst abuses, and only the more dangerous because it presented itself under false colors. Historian Amarjeet Kaur documented that Kanganis indulged in coercion. They kidnapped minors and caught recruits at weekly markets. They seduced young men with promises of getting them married in the colony. They misrepresented the nature of work and the rates of wages on the estates. One Tamil mother, interviewed in 1983, recalled, "Many were picked up from the roadside in Madras and put on boats to come here." A colonial report documented, "There's a regularly organized system in this district of kidnapping men and children and taking them down to coolie godowns in Negapatam, to be shipped from there to Penang and other places, which are thus regularly supplied with men as coolies and girls as prostitutes." Men as coolies, girls as prostitutes. This wasn't a side effect. It was part of the system. Once workers arrived in Malaya, estate mortality rates during the rubber boom years ran at 30 per thousand, 3% dying every year. For context, Britain's civilian death rate during World War I was less than 1%. Working on a Malayan rubber estate was 3 times deadlier than being a British civilian during the Great War. Between 1886 and 1957, approximately 750,000 Tamil workers died during migration and on estates. Some scholars dispute this figure's methodology. The number includes deaths during ocean voyages, deaths from disease shortly after arrival, and deaths on estates. But even conservative estimates acknowledge hundreds of thousands of deaths. Each one was someone's child. Each one had a name. We know one of them. Ramasamy. Beaten to death on the Malakoff estate in 1874 because someone needed to maintain discipline. In 1884, male Tamil workers on rubber estates earned 12 cents per day. Female workers earned 8 cents. By 1923, male wages had risen to 40 cents. Female wages had reached 30 cents. That sounds like progress. Until you do the math. 39 years. 28 cents of wage growth for men. That's an increase of 0.72 cents per year. But wait. By 1941, 57 years after 1884, male wages had only reached 50 cents. 38 cents of total growth over 57 years. That's 0.67 cents per year. Less than 1 cent of annual wage increase for nearly 6 decades. The British newspaper The Observer visited estates in the 1930s and wrote, "Several times I have been shown with pride coolie lines on plantations that a kennel man in England would not tolerate for his hounds." Shown with pride. One employer, when questioned about low wages, stated that Indians would work less and become lazy if they were paid more, as they were essentially a satisfied lot and were better off here than in India. Meanwhile, Chinese tappers on the same estates were paid 50 to 100% more than Tamil workers for identical work. 50 to 100% more for the exact same job. In 1912, the Federated Malay States Labor Code mandated that estates provide accommodation for workers. By 1923, the code provided for estate schools and nurseries. On paper, the system was becoming more humane. On paper. A 1936 report by V. Srimavasa Sastry, a one-man committee investigating Indian worker conditions, documented systematic abuses. In 1938, the government of India banned all assisted immigration to Malaya. Not because Britain ended the Kangani system, because India stopped supplying workers. K.A. Nilakandayar, writing in 1938, predicted that Indians in Malaya would become tragic orphans, of whom India has forgotten and Malaya looks down upon with contempt. But by 1938, the rubber industry had other problems. The Great Depression had devastated global prices. Between 1929 and 1932, Malayan rubber exports fell 73%. Prices crashed to 1/100th of the 1910 peak. Tan Kah Kee, called the Henry Ford of Malaya, saw his empire collapse in 1934. At his peak, he'd controlled 15,000 acres, 30 factories, 150 retail outlets, and 30,000 employees. His net worth had exceeded 12 million yuan. He'd founded Xiamen University in 1921. All gone. But before the depression, before the collapse, before everything fell apart, there was a moment when the British rubber monopoly seemed unshakable. A moment when Winston Churchill thought Britain could use that monopoly to make America pay. By 1919, Malaya's rubber exports exceeded the rest of the world combined. Britain controlled 75% of global rubber supply. During World War I, the British naval blockade had cut Germany's rubber supply entirely. After the war, prices collapsed. By 1920-21, rubber had fallen to 9 pence per pound. On February 1921, Winston Churchill became Secretary of State for the colonies. The British Rubber Growers Association immediately petitioned him for market intervention. Churchill's response was telling. He said, "One of the principal means of paying our debt to the United States is in the provision of rubber." Britain owed America money from the war. America needed rubber. Churchill saw an opportunity. He appointed Sir James Stevenson to chair a rubber investigation committee. Stevenson was the joint managing director of Johnnie Walker Whiskey. He'd created the slogan born in 1820, still going strong. Now he was tasked with designing a commodity cartel, something that would not, ironically, remained strong. On October 1922, the Federal Legislative Council of Malaya passed the Export of Rubber Restriction Enactment. On November 1, 1922, the Stevenson Plan was officially enacted. Here's how it worked. Britain would restrict rubber exports from Malaya and Ceylon based on historical production quotas. If you'd produced a certain amount in the base years, 1919 and 1920, you could export that amount plus or minus adjustments based on current prices. When prices were low, export quotas would be reduced to restrict supply. When prices were high, quotas would be increased. The goal was simple: artificially manipulate global supply to keep prices elevated. It worked brilliantly for a while. In 1922, rubber sold for about 17 cents per pound. By 1925, prices had peaked at $1.21 per pound. That was a 712% increase in 3 years. Herbert Hoover, U.S. Secretary of Commerce, was furious. He declared that the Stevenson Plan threatened the American way of life. The Rubber Association of America calculated that, as a result of the operation of the scheme, the price of rubber has been forced up to about 3 times the normal price of 36 cents. American automobile production was exploding. Henry Ford's Model T was selling millions. Every single car needed rubber tires. And Britain controlled the supply. American industrialists faced a choice: pay Britain's inflated prices and watch profits evaporate, or find rubber elsewhere. In the summer of 1925, Henry Ford sat down to lunch with Harvey Firestone in Dearborn, Michigan. Two of America's most powerful industrialists discussed their options. Firestone would secure a 99-year lease for 1 million acres in Liberia, 6 cents per acre. Ford would secure 2.5 million acres in the Brazilian Amazon. Both men believed they could break Britain's monopoly. both would be wrong. But not for the reasons they thought. The Stevenson plan had one critical flaw. The Dutch East Indies refused to participate. Dutch planters in Sumatra and Java watched British Malaya artificially restrict its own production, and they simply increased theirs. Dutch exports surged. They captured market share. They built new capacity. By 1927, prices had collapsed back to 6 pence per pound. Sir James Stevenson, the man who designed the scheme, died on June 10, 1926, aged 53. Churchill wrote a tribute. During his 10 years of public service, for honor alone, Lord Stevenson wore out the whole of his exceptional strength of mind and body. On November 1, 1928, the Stevenson Plan was officially repealed. Exactly 6 years after it began, it had achieved nothing except strengthening Dutch competitors and prompting American industrialists to pursue disastrous independent rubber ventures in Africa and South America. But here's the darkly comic part. In December 1928, 1 month after the Stevenson Plan's repeal, Henry Ford's ships arrived at the Fordlandia site in Brazil. The economic rationale for the project had evaporated. Ford persisted anyway. For 17 more years. In 1945, he'd sell Fordlandia and Belterra back to Brazil at a massive loss. As NPR later reported, not one drop of latex from Fordlandia ever made it into a Ford car. Greg Grandin, Ford's biographer, wrote, "Ford's great delusion was not that the Amazon could be tamed, but that the forces of capitalism, once released, might yet be contained." The same delusion applied to Churchill's rubber cartel. Britain believed it could control global markets through colonial power. The Dutch proved them wrong. And someone else was watching Malaya's rubber supplies with great interest. The 1930s in Malaya were called Tory Eden by British capitalists. One historian wrote that the enterprise was so lucrative that one writer even labeled Malaya in the 1930s as a Tory Eden. Then he added, "The Japanese invasion in World War II destroyed this hubris forever." But before the destruction, there was prosperity. For some. By 1922, 2.26 million acres were under rubber cultivation in Malaya. 60% European ownership, 40% Asian. Chinese entrepreneurs had become major players. Tan Chay Yen, who died in 1916, had created Asia's first rubber plantation in 1896. In 1900, he received a trophy for being the first man in the world to produce commercial sheet rubber. Chung Kin Kui, the captain in China, controlled the Penang-based Hysan Secret Society and the Larat Tin Fields. He had over 15,000 coolies under his control. In 1887, he was the largest tin producer in Perak, 29,000 pickles out of 220,000 for the entire state. He donated 100,000 taels to the Qing government for the Sino-French War. He built the Penang Peranakan Mansion on the former Guy Hin headquarters. But the biggest was Tan Kah Kee. Born in 1874 in Jime, Fujian Province, Tan arrived in Singapore as a teenager. By his peak, he controlled 15,000 acres of rubber plantations, 30 factories, 150 retail outlets, 30,000 employees. His net worth exceeded 12 million yuan. In 1921, he founded Xiamen University with 2 million yuan of his own money. He believed in education, in modernization, in the Chinese diaspora contributing to China's development. Then the Great Depression hit. Between 1929 and 1932, Malayan rubber exports fell 73%. Rubber prices crashed to 1/100th of the 1910 peak. By 1932, male workers were earning 20 to 25 cents per day, less than they'd earned in 1923. Wages had gone backward. Tan Kah Kee's business empire collapsed in 1934. He lost everything except his commitment to Xiamen University, which he continued supporting until the Japanese invasion of China forced him into even greater financial distress. In June 1934, Britain signed the International Rubber Regulation Agreement with the Dutch and French. Another cartel. Another attempt to control global markets. This one would last longer than the Stevenson Plan, but it wouldn't survive the war. Because by the late 1930s, someone else was looking at Malaya's rubber supplies. Someone who needed rubber for a war machine. Someone who'd been cut off from Western supplies by embargoes. Japan. In 1942, a Canadian rubber regulator named Alan H. Williamson wrote that rubber alone constitutes one of the gravest and most ominous problems in our history. His colleague J. R. Nicholson was more direct. The loss of plantations in the Far East, he wrote, has placed the whole Allied war program in jeopardy. Japan invaded Malaya on December 8, 1941, landing at Kotobaru. 2 days later, Japanese aircraft sank HMS Prince of Wales and HMS Repulse. On February 15, 1942, Singapore fell. 85,000 Allied troops surrendered. Winston Churchill, the same Churchill who'd launched the Stevenson Plan 20 years earlier, called it the worst disaster and largest capitulation in British history. One British lord would later describe Malaya as the greatest material prize in Southeast Asia. Another said, "What we should do without Malaya and its earnings in tin and rubber, I do not know." The colonial secretary Arthur Creech Jones admitted in 1948, "It would gravely worsen the whole dollar balance of the sterling area if there were serious interference with Malayan exports." The war wasn't just about ideology. It was about rubber. Between February 18th and March 4th, 1942, Japanese forces conducted what became known as the Suk Ching Massacre. Suk Ching means purge through cleansing. General Tomoyuki Yamashita, called the Tiger of Malaya, commanded the conquest. But the order for Suk Ching came from Colonel Masanobu Tsuji, Chief of Planning and Operations for the 25th Army. Chinese men aged 18 to 50 were ordered to report for screening. Those suspected of anti-Japanese sentiment, which could mean almost anything, were taken away. The official Japanese count is 5,000 to 6,000 deaths. Lee Kuan Yew, who lived through the occupation, estimated 70,000. Historians generally accept 25,000 to 50,000 as more likely. Japan has never conducted a formal investigation. Major Hayashi Tadahiko later told a correspondent that half of the planned 50,000 Chinese had been killed before orders came to stop. Half of 50,000. 25,000. Before they stopped. Chia Chusu's father, uncles, aunts, brothers, and sisters were bayoneted one by one by Japanese soldiers in Simpang Village. Evelyn Teo was 13 years old during the war. She dressed as a boy to avoid being abducted as a comfort woman. She remembers seeing thieves hung from trees by Japanese soldiers in Kuantan. 5 bodies. 5 trees. Colonel Tsuji, the man who ordered the killing of 50,000 Chinese, 20% of Singapore's Chinese population, escaped war crimes trials. He became a Japanese politician. He disappeared in Laos in 1961. General Yamashita was executed in the Philippines in 1946. But Tsuji lived free for 16 more years. Lee Kuan Yew later wrote, that the Japanese showed a meanness and viciousness towards their enemies equal to the Huns. Genghis Khan and his hordes could not have been more merciless, he continued. I have no doubts about whether the two atom bombs were necessary. But Suk Ching wasn't the only Japanese atrocity in Malaya. There was also the Death Railway. In 1943, 78,204 Malayans were forced to work on the Burma Railway. 41% of them died, 30,000 to 60,000 deaths. The Japanese had promised free train rides, health care, housing, and a daily salary of one straight dollar, compared to the 15 to 25 cents the British had been paying during the Depression. This sounded generous. M. Ponusamy was working at Ladon Cashwood when Japanese agents came recruiting. They called it volunteering. At Taiping train station, Ponusamy realized what he'd actually signed up for. 400 to 500 Ramusha, forced laborers, were crammed into cattle cars. On the train, he met another man also named Ponusamy. This man had been forced to leave his young wife and aging mother behind. The most unforgettable experience, M. Ponusamy later recalled, was having to sleep with a corpse because he was too exhausted to move. Sometimes the corpse was headless. Sometimes he used the corpse as a pillow. The other Ponusamy died from starvation, torture, and exhaustion. Before dying, he asked M. Ponusamy to care for his family. After the war, M. Ponusamy escaped by following the train tracks home. He married his friend's widow. He took care of her mother. He kept his promise. K. N. Salapa was 27 when recruited as a field conductor at Ladong Baikom. He went with his friends. When he returned to Malaysia in 1945, only 47 of his friends had survived. Until his death, Salapa was disappointed that neither Japan nor Britain compensated the Ramusha families. Neither Japan nor Britain. Both had exploited them. Neither paid. Dr. Robert Hardy, a British POW and plantation manager, wrote about what he witnessed. A lot of Tamil Chinese and Malay laborers from Malaya have been brought up forcibly to work on the railway, he documented. They were told that they were going to Alor Star in northern Malaya, that conditions would be good, light work, good food, and good quarters. Once on the train, however, they were kept under guard and brought right up to Siam. The wretched natives, Hardy continued, lived with corpses rotting unburied in the jungle, almost complete lack of sanitation, frightful stench, overcrowding, swarms of flies. Muniyadi Ramasamy recalled the moment he was taken. The soldiers forced me to get into the lorry. I was wearing only a pair of shorts and sandals. The Japanese soldiers did not allow me to go home. Instead, they sent me directly to Kuala Lumpur and loaded me onto a freight train for Siam. There we started cutting dense jungle. I had to work in the jungle and sleep on the bamboo floor in a hut, half naked and without any blanket. Natarajan Arasimulu, the 18-year-old we met at the beginning, remembered hearing the screams. Those deemed too sick to live. Buried alive. By October 1943, the Burma Railway was completed. 258 miles. 90,000 civilian deaths. 12,000 Allied POW deaths. Patricia Lurichair remembers hiding in toilets to escape being raped by Japanese soldiers. Her father was working as chief clerk of Chariot Estate, but was taken away to the railway. Sybil Kathagasu, the only Malayan woman awarded the George Medal, provided medical care and radio information to Mpaja guerrillas during the occupation. She was arrested in August 1943, tortured by the Kempeitai, Japanese military police. her 7-year-old daughter Dawn was threatened with burning to extract information from Sybil. Sybil refused to talk. She was sentenced to life imprisonment. She survived. She wrote her memoir, No Dram of Mercy. Her torturer, Sergeant Yoshimura Ikkyo, was executed at Taiping Prison on May 24, 1946. In August 1945, Japan surrendered. Mpaja, Malayan People's Anti-Japanese Army, briefly controlled parts of Malaya. Many of them were communists. Many had fought alongside British officers during the war. Britain had armed them, trained them, worked with them. 3 years later, Britain would be hunting them through the jungle. Between 1945 and 1946, labor unrest swept through Malaya like a fever. 27 strikes per week, for 7 consecutive weeks. 713,000 worker days lost. On January 29, 1946, 150,000 to 200,000 workers struck in Singapore. By April 1947, the Pan-Malayan Federation of Trade Unions had reached 263,598 members. Workers were demanding an end to abuse by non-European staff, an end to molestation of their women by European and non-European staff, basic human dignity. As one historical account put it, Tamil trade unionists refused to suffer any longer the use of the derogatory term kling. Estate workers no longer dismounted from their bicycles when a Dorai, a planter, passed by. These weren't revolutionary demands. They were asking not to be insulted, not to dismount their bicycles like servants. And the British treated it as a crisis. On March 1947, police shot and killed one worker at Dublin Estate. 5 others were wounded. Tensions escalated. On June 16, 1948, at 8:30 in the morning, A.E. Walker was shot at his office desk. He was the manager of Elphill Estate in Sungai Sipit, Perak. 2 Chinese men arrived on bicycles. They said good morning. Then they fired. Walker's friends called him Wally. He'd been one of the original gardeners in Japanese prison camps, prisoners who risked their lives growing food for fellow POWs. His obituary described him as always ready and willing to help a pal not so gifted in the art of existing. That same day, John Allison, aged 55, manager of Finsoon Estate, was shot. His hands were tied. His automatic pistol had been seized. He was executed in cold blood. Ian Christian, a young assistant manager, was tied up and shot alongside him. The next day, June 17, 1948, Britain declared an emergency in Malaya. Not a war. An emergency. And this is where it gets darkly absurd. Former British soldier Len Barrett later explained why it was called an emergency. The Malayan Planters Association did not wish the war to be referred to as such owing to their lack of war risk liabilities insurance cover. Lloyd's of London wouldn't pay claims if it was officially a war, so it was an emergency. Foreign Minister Robert Scott confirmed this in 1950. The decision to call the insurgents bandits or terrorists was taken originally because of the insurance implications of the words insurgents or rebels or enemy. Jide, Hyam of the Colonial Office, was even more explicit. On no account should the term insurgent, which might suggest a genuine popular uprising, be used. Couldn't suggest a genuine popular uprising, even though that's exactly what it was. A Foreign Office secret file, later declassified, stated the truth plainly. In its narrower context, the war against bandits is very much a war in defense of the rubber industry. in defense of the rubber industry. Not defending democracy. Not fighting communism. Defending rubber profits. One British lord said it in the House of Lords in 1952. What we should do without Malaya and its earnings in tin and rubber, I do not know. Another called Malaya the greatest material prize in Southeast Asia. By 1949, 10,000 suspected communist sympathizers had been deported to China. 10,000. Without trials. Without appeals. Just deported. In April 1950, Sir Harold Briggs was appointed director of operations. He looked at the problem. Chinese squatters living on the jungle's edge, potentially supplying food to MNLA guerrillas, and came up with a solution. Forced resettlement. Mass internment. Concentration camps with a prettier name. In May 1950, the Briggs Plan was issued. 500,000 to 573,000 Chinese squatters would be forcibly resettled into new villages. Historian Brian Lapping described the process. A community of squatters would be surrounded in their huts at dawn, when they were all asleep, forced into lorries, and settled in a new village encircled by barbed wire with searchlights round the periphery to prevent movement at night. Surrounded at dawn. Forced into lorries. Barbed wire. Searchlights. Chin Peng, Secretary General of the Malayan Communist Party, later recalled what happened if people refused. They forced you to go, and they burned all your house. And then if you want to resist, you stay in the house, they don't care. They would burn you. Some people stayed in the house. They did not want to move. If you don't move, then maybe you have to be burned alive. Burned alive if you refuse to move. This was British policy in 1950. A Hakka song from Tra's new village captured the experience. The bamboo music was lively and rousing. How miserable Tra's resettlement was. Here another meal with dried and salted fish. A deeply bitter experience we suffer in silence. Historian John Neusinger wrote that people in new villages were effectively deprived of all civil rights. But it wasn't just Chinese squatters who suffered. Up to 7,000 Orang Asli, indigenous peoples, died during resettlement operations. This figure comes from a former Director General of the Department of Aboriginal Affairs. 7,000. The original inhabitants of Malaya. Dead in camps. The Aboriginal People's Ordinance was enacted in 1954, after the deaths, supposedly to protect them. On October 6, 1951, Sir Henry Gurney, High Commissioner for Malaya, was assassinated at mile 56 and a half of the Kuala Kubu Road. His convoy was ambushed. When bullets started hitting his car, Gurney pushed his wife into the footwell. Then he exited the vehicle and walked toward his ambushers to draw their fire away from her. He died on the road. His epitaph reads, "Greater love hath no man than this." Chin Peng later confirmed that the guerrillas hadn't known Gurney was in the convoy. They'd been targeting a different vehicle. He died by accident. In January 1952, Britain appointed someone new. Sir Gerald Templer, High Commissioner and Director of Operations, combined civil and military authority. And Templer had a phrase that would become famous. Sir Gerald Templer is famous for saying, "The answer lies not in pouring more soldiers into the jungle, but in the hearts and minds of the Malayan people." Hearts and minds. This is where that phrase comes from. Not from Vietnam. From Malaya. It would be used in Vietnam. In Iraq. In Afghanistan. Every counterinsurgency, since as repeated Templars, words like a mantra. But here's what Templar actually did while winning hearts and minds. He ordered 22-hour curfews for entire villages suspected evading guerrillas. 22 hours. 2 hours per day to live. He reduced rice rations for 20,000 civilians. Collective punishment. Starve the civilians, and maybe they'll stop feeding the guerrillas. The London School of Hygiene warned, this measure is bound to result in an increase, not only of sickness, but also of deaths, particularly amongst the mothers and very young children. Templar proceeded anyway. In April 1952, photographs were published. British soldiers posing with severed heads. Templar had approved the use of Dayak headhunters from Borneo. British officers led them. They tracked guerrillas through the jungle and brought back heads as trophies. A Colonial Office internal note later admitted, there is no doubt that under international law a similar case in wartime would be a war crime. But they called it an emergency. So apparently it didn't count. In the summer of 1952, Britain began spraying herbicides from aircraft. 2,4,5-T, the same chemical that would later be used as Agent Orange in Vietnam. The goal was to destroy jungle cover and food crops that might feed guerrillas. The reality was poisoning the land and everyone on it. Templar also said, I'll shoot the bastard who says that this emergency is over. And the hardcore of armed communists in this country are fanatics and must be, and will be, exterminated. Exterminated. That was the word he used. On December 12, 1948, before Templar's appointment, but part of the same emergency, the Badong Kali massacre occurred. Scots guards killed 24 unarmed Chinese civilians. The official story was that the men were shot while escaping. Evidence suggests they were lined up and executed. The village was burned. In 2015, 67 years later, the UK Supreme Court ruled that no public inquiry was required. Too much time had passed. 4 years into the emergency, the Colonial Office quietly noted something interesting. No operational links have been established as existing between the MNLA and Soviet or Chinese communists. No operational links. 4 years into a war supposedly about stopping communist expansion, and there were no operational links to communist powers. Chin Peng would later say, colonial exploitation, irrespective of who were the masters, Japanese or British, was morally wrong. On December 28th and 29th, 1955, peace talks were held in Beiling. Chin Peng met with Tunku Abdul Rahman, who would become Malaya's first prime minister. The talks failed. On August 31st, 1957, Malaya gained independence from Britain. But here's the thing. British companies retained control of tin mines and rubber plantations. Political independence. Economic colonialism. The emergency officially ended on July 31, 1960. 12 years. 6,710 to 6,781 MNLA guerrillas killed, depending on the source. 500 to 1,442 British military deaths. Civilian deaths remain poorly documented. Nobody counted carefully. Chin Peng had been awarded the OB by Britain for his anti-Japanese resistance during World War II. The British gave him a medal. Then they hunted him for 60 years. The award was withdrawn. On December 2, 1989, Chin Peng signed the Hat Yai Peace Agreement. The fighting finally stopped. 41 years after it began. Malaysia banned him from returning to the country. He died in exile in Bangkok on September 16, 2013. 99 years old. Never allowed home. Sir Harold Briggs, architect of the New Villages, died in 1952. His health destroyed by service. Henry Wickham died on September 27, 1928. He'd been knighted by King George V on June 3, 1920, for services to the rubber industry. He spent his final years poor at the Royal Colonial Club. In Brazil, he's called the father of biopiracy and Prince of Thieves. Today, 613 new villages remain across Malaysia. The original Briggs Plan layouts are preserved. Barbed wire replaced with parks. Searchlights removed. They're being considered for UNESCO World Heritage nomination. Concentration camps as heritage sites. The oldest rubber tree from 1895 still stands near Kuala Kangsar Clock Tower. Descended from Wickham's stolen seeds. Velu Saminathan, a Malaysian historian, wrote about the Tamil workers. Despite the privations and a hostile environment, these laborers prevailed and laid the foundations of the rubber industry. They remain unsung and buried in anonymity, many dying prematurely after earning a pittance for their backbreaking toil. C. Raja traveled from India to British Malaya around 1920. He made his home at Foothills Estate, Kaleem. His descendant wrote a photo essay about the family. It was, the descendant explained, an attempt to counter the stereotype in modern Malaysia that those who come from the estates are to be regarded as uncultured, illiterate, and poor. That's what 70 years of exploitation bought. A stereotype of poverty and ignorance. Between 1876 and 1960, one act of seed theft created a commodity empire that spanned three continents. It ended Congo's red rubber. Not through moral pressure. Through economic competition that made plantation rubber cheaper than Leopold's wild rubber extracted through mutilation and severed hands. Raja Casement's Congo Reform Association closed operations in 1913. The same year, cultivated rubber overtook wild rubber globally. Mission accomplished. Not because the atrocities stopped. Because they moved. It drove Henry Ford to his greatest failure. In the summer of 1925, Ford and Firestone met in Dearborn to discuss Churchill's rubber cartel. Ford went to Brazil. Firestone went to Liberia. Both failed spectacularly. Not one drop of Fordlandia latex ever made it into a Ford car. It killed 750,000 Tamil workers during migration and on estates. Some scholars dispute this number. Even conservative estimates acknowledge hundreds of thousands. We know one of their names. Ramasamy. Beaten to death at Malakoff Estate in 1874. We know others. M. Ponusamy, who slept with corpses on the death railway and kept his promise to marry his dead friend's widow. Natarajan Arasimulu, who heard the screams of those buried alive because they were too sick to work. Wally Walker, shot at his desk on June 16, 1948. By men who said good morning first. It prompted Japan's conquest of Southeast Asia. Malaya was the greatest material prize in Southeast Asia. Between 25,000 and 70,000 Chinese died in the Suk Ching massacre. 30,000 to 60,000 Malayans died on the Death Railway. And it sparked Britain's forgotten war. Called an emergency so Lloyd's of London would pay insurance claims. Fought explicitly, as the Foreign Office admitted, in defense of the rubber industry. Winston Churchill played both ends of the story. As colonial secretary in 1922, he launched the Stevenson Plan to exploit American dependence on rubber, He said, "One of the principal means of paying our debt to the United States is in the provision of rubber." As Prime Minister in 1952, he appointed Gerald Templer to fight communists to preserve rubber profits. Templer coined hearts and minds while ordering 22-hour curfews, reducing rice rations for 20,000 civilians, approving Dayak headhunters, and spraying herbicides that would later be banned as war crimes in Vietnam. Over 57 years, wages for Tamil workers rose from 12 cents to 50 cents per day. That's 0.67 cents of annual increase. Less than 1 cent per year. For nearly six decades. Each one was someone's child. The British rubber monopoly in Malaya represents one of history's most successful commodity cartels. It also represents one of history's most devastating. Different methods across three continents. Congo's mutilation. Amazon's Putumayo genocide. Malaya's colony system and emergency internment. Same commodity. Same consumers. Same silence about the human cost. In Brazil, Henry Wickham is called the Prince of Thieves. In Malaysia, there are monuments to him. In London, he died poor and forgotten at the Royal Colonial Club. In the new villages of Malaysia, 613 concentration camps have been converted into towns. Barbed wire replaced with parks. Searchlights removed. Being considered for UNESCO World Heritage status. The oldest rubber tree still stands near Kuala Kangsar Clock Tower. Descended from 70,000 stolen seeds, of which only 2,700 germinated. But 2,700 was enough.